Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Church Leadership Lab, where we get to have conversations that help empower healthy churches. My name is Scott, and I get to host this podcast alongside of Casey. Hello, Casey. How are you?
I'm good. I feel like I haven't seen you in a long time. I know it's a weird, we can't like explain the time lapse, but you went on a really big trip and I didn't see you for a while. So like, I want to say welcome back, which is weird to anyone other than me.
Yep. Yeah, they're like, we just heard a podcast last week.
What are you talking about? She's silly. Like, no, you've been gone.
The magic of the internet.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. We were gone. We were in Africa for a couple weeks and just an amazing trip serving a place there called Kajani Farm. Shout out to Kajani Farm. Go Google that and then donate $1 million to them because they're doing
only just a million
best work.
That's it.
No, they're doing amazing work with the Maasai people there and really transforming a community. So we got to be a part of that for a little bit and it was wonderful.
I want to do a whole episode. I want to flip all this script. I want to interview you and like put you on that. You never get to do that. I want to know everything about it.
Hey, that we can do that. It could be like a bonus episode, or we don't have any, is it Patreon where you sort of like, you know, pay a little extra, you get the bonus content. We don't have that yet.
Man. But people have been knocking down the doors, begging for it, haven't they?
Yeah, it's probably not going to happen. But if we did, we could include that interview there.
You know who would love it? Our moms. Our moms would love it.
Yep. Yep. Right. Yeah. My mom is the founder and president of my fan club. So
I love it.
Well, I'm excited for our conversation today. We're again, like any conversation we have, we want it to be helpful and serve church leaders, even when sometimes it can be a challenging topic. Today, we get to talk with Chris Krim. Chris is the director of operations for the Memphis Child Advocacy Center, where he oversees all aspects of their operations. Now, he joined the Memphis Child Advocacy Center in 2015 and served as the prevention director, where he and his team work to provide evidence-informed stewards of children, child sexual abuse prevention, and response training to businesses, churches, schools, and youth-serving organizations. Now, under Chris's leadership, the Memphis Child Advocacy Center prevention team trained over 25,000 adults and provided over 1,200 training sessions. Now, the Memphis Child Advocacy Center's prevention team is actually recognized on both a state and a national level as one of the top providers of the Stewards of Children training. Now, Chris is a graduate of Creighton College in Memphis, Tennessee, where he earned a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. And we are really excited, Chris, to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, Scott and Casey, thank you all so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, looking forward to our conversation. Now, as we jump in, you know, I just read kind of the public bio. I know sometimes there's things that don't make that. And so what's something that doesn't make the public bio for you that all your friends and family would know about you?
Yeah, something that all my friends and family know is I'm a huge University of Memphis fan, a sports fan. So I like both U of M basketball and football. You know, unfortunately, basketball did not pan out for us this season. But we are always rooting for the hometown Tigers. My parents love and it. Family have always been of the thought and the idea that you need to support the hometown team. And so we have always been avid fans of the University of Memphis and their sports programs. So huge U of M fan. I'm also a car guy. And that's something my friends and families know. So very much in the car culture and into cars. So I come by it naturally. My grandfather was a big car guy. And so I'm very much into that and enjoy that. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
So what would be like your dream car, no budget, no decade? What is the one?
Oh, wow. Casey, that is a really good question. And that is one, it's hard to narrow down. So, you know, I don't know. I've owned five or six Camaros. I have one currently. And, you know, I had my first car was a Camaro in high school. So I've always kind of had those. And so I would say maybe a 67, 68, 69 Camaro for kind of a classic car. I also like Corvettes a lot, too. But I appreciate cars of all makes and models. So I'm not just a Chevy guy. I like, you know, Dodges and Fords and other stuff, too. Yeah. My grandfather had a classic truck, a 1935 Ford. that he had when he was a younger man and was able to acquire that vehicle again later on in life and restored it. And that was in my family for a long time and was actually featured in the movie Walk the Line in 2005. Oh, cool. And he had a small little bit part in that film. Wow. So that was kind of cool. But yeah, I like old and new. I can appreciate it all and definitely appreciate cars from all different manufacturers. So
that's so it's fun. Awesome. Well, my yeah. grandfather was an old mechanic as well. I don't think he was in any movies, but yeah.
That's yeah.
So
fun. Yeah, that was, you know, like, you know, you have to like pause the film to see him. You can't even see him. We just know his family that he's the one driving the truck, but you can't really see him at all, even though he was in costume, period correct. But there are like two little 5 or 8 second snippets. There's two different scenes where his truck is in that movie. And he could not have been prouder being that it was That's filmed so in cool. Arkansas. And he did a lot of his racing in Arkansas back in the day. And so he just, he grew up in Memphis as well. So the connections to, you know, Johnny Cash and Elvis and everything that was happening in music here in Memphis around that time, he was kind of around. Matter of fact, he went to Humes High School with Elvis Presley. I don't think they were in the same class, but he remembers Elvis, and Elvis was either, I don't remember, a year or two older or younger than him. And, he talked about what an interesting fellow Elvis was back in the day. But yeah, a lot of connections there. And as a matter of fact, I think that he and Elvis, I think Lauderdale Court was the apartment complex that Elvis lived in at the time he went to Humes High School here in Memphis. And my grandfather was actually also a resident of that same apartment complex. So again, a lot of connections to kind of Memphis music, nothing stronger than that. But yeah. He knew who Elvis was and, you know, had some interaction there. So, yeah,
it's awesome.
Well, those sound like better bragging rights than the current basketball situation, but we'll let you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I will gladly put my family and their accomplishments as individuals and outstanding people well above our sports team. So
that's probably a safe bet for this year.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Those are the folks that are most important to me and the folks that I really look up to. So my parents and my grandparents, those are the rock stars in my book. So I've been extremely blessed to grow up and be raised by some wonderful people.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, you have got so much experience and so much knowledge. So I want to bring us out of cars and movies and sports a little bit and talk about really what you are here, your expertise. Really want to talk about that safe environment. If we can just dive right into providing that safe environment, especially for children and especially in churches. So kind of leveraging your experience and your knowledge, what are some of the absolute most basic things that we can think about as we're providing that safe environment for our kids in churches?
Yeah. I one thing I always like to tell folks is, you know, I think it's important that we create a culture of safety. And, you know, one example that I use, and just because it's so prevalent in marketing and in our country, is, you know, ADT, right? Most folks know what ADT home protection is, and they are kind of a premier provider of home alarm systems. But you know, I always tell people you want to have that virtual ADT sign out in front of your church and out in front of your business. And I don't mean that literal sense, but when folks walk in our doors and to our houses of worship, we want them to immediately get the idea and get the feeling and get the presence of, you know, the culture of safety that permeates through all of our programs and through all of our activities here at this church. The adults are on the lookout, that the topic of conversation around child safety is something that is apparent and is ongoing and something that's heard. It's not something that's done behind closed doors in an office amongst, you know, two or three different people who are in church leadership, that we want everyone in our church body, in our house of worship, to be talking about child safety and be aware that is something that is of the utmost importance to us. You know, as a Christian, I certainly think that the Bible speaks to the importance of children and, you know, God's emphasis on that and their innocence and innate righteousness and things of that nature. So I think it's something that should be readily apparent to anyone who walks in our doors and nothing that we should be hiding or not talking about. I think churches having a strong child protection policy that is reviewed on hopefully an annual basis, if not at least every 2 years. Likewise, having a code of conduct, I think, is really important. You know, doing reference checks and background checks, all those things that need to be ongoing and a part of our kind of culture of safety within our church or our house of worship is really important. And making sure that we have those standards both for staff and for volunteers, because we know that many of our teachers and volunteers and folks who are helping us run all these programs for children and youth, they're not staff members, they're volunteers of the church, whether it be church members themselves or folks who are coming in to help us. So making sure that we are screening those folks as well, not just our staff members.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think too, one of the things that I know the church can sometimes be guilty of, obviously the goal is to love and engage people and to, you know, welcome people in. But at times the church can be a little bit too naive and maybe a little too trusting. And this can lead to, unfortunately, sometimes trusting the wrong people. So I'd love if you could unpack for people, how can the church be wise and alert when it comes to specifically child abuse?
Yeah. Again, I think having that ongoing conversation is key, but I also think we need to be aware of the fact that child perpetrators are looking for environments in places where children spend time. Mm-hmm. And that very well includes our churches and our houses of worship as well. So children spend, you know, may come to church a couple times a week for various programs. They're there on Sundays and may be involved in, you know, vacation Bible school and other things. You know, in situations like that, it may be children who are not always in our church doors, but are here for a short period of time with us. It could be, obviously, a lot of churches have sports programs and things of that nature, other activities, choirs, you know, other ministry opportunities for children to be involved in and plugged into, Awana, whatever the case may be. So, again, in all those areas, we need to be aware that child perpetrators are looking for places and spaces where children spend time. Mm-hmm. That could very well be a church and that can certainly be the case. So, you know, we have to be aware that everyone who enters our doors, who's looking to volunteer with our children, we may not and don't need to trust completely. That trust needs to be earned, and we need to be background checking and screening everyone. Churches are not immune from people who are looking to abuse children. So, you know, one thing we always like to remind people at the Child Advocacy Center is that, you know, we often think about how child perpetrators groom children and how good they can be at that. And they are quite good at that. But they are also really good at grooming the adults around those children. You know, a lot of folks ask me when they hear that I work at the Child Advocacy Center, they'll say, Chris, what does a child perpetrator look like? What do I need to be on the lookout for? And I'll typically say, you know, do you own a mirror? They look just like you and me. They are folks in our community who are seen as leaders, upstanding individuals, folks who are willing to lend a helping hand, volunteer, help out. That is very much their MO. So they're very good at what they do and manipulating not only the children in their lives, but also the adults around those children. So again, you know, I always tell people, I don't want you to live in fear, and I don't want us to hinder anything that we're doing within the church as far as our ministries go and our outreach and our programs. That is all critical and of vital importance. But what I do want us to do is to be informed. And I think there's a difference between living in fear and being informed. So if we know what to look for, if we're creating safe spaces, if we have the right policies in place, if we're doing everything we can to keep what I view as the most valuable aspect of our congregation, which is our children, if we're doing everything in our power to keep them safe, then we're okay. But, you know, we have to take strong steps to do that. And sometimes that lends itself to some difficult conversations and conversations that not all churches are comfortable with and not all church leaders are comfortable, you know, kind of leading that charge. We fully acknowledge that talking about, you know, sex and sexuality, particularly child abuse and child sexual abuse, you know, these are not always easy conversations to have. And I don't mean to pigeonhole all churches that, you know, every church out there has difficulty doing so. But we certainly know that for some churches, that can be a difficult conversation to have. But again, just because it's a difficult conversation does not mean it's not an important one.
Right. Yeah. Or that we just avoid it. We don't know how to have it. So like, let's just not have it. No, we got to dig in and get the resources. Well, Chris, what are maybe if we don't even know where to begin, like, you know, God forbid, let's say that abuse is discovered. What are the very basic steps that a church leader should take to address that when something is discovered?
And again, I don't want to pigeonhole, but I think some churches attempt to handle these situations amongst themselves and to do an internal investigation or to have maybe the perpetrator as well as the child victim come meet with a pastor or a senior church leader to do some counseling or to mediate through this situation. And that is entirely inappropriate. As residents of the state of Tennessee, as well as Mississippi, we are what's called universal mandated reporters. And that means that anyone age 18 or older in our state has both not only a moral obligation, but a legal obligation to report any suspicions of child abuse and neglect. So that is our legal responsibility. So if we have any suspicions or if we have any information or if a child discloses to us that they have been abused, we have an immediate responsibility. You know, as we teach stewards of children to groups of adults out in our community, including churches and houses of worship, I often use the terminology first responder. We are empowering folks to be first responders. If you're an adult in our state, you are in this regard, you are a first responder. The state wants to hear from you if you have any concerns about a child's safety, right? So, the first thing to do is to make that report. And we teach folks and stewards of children about how to do that. We give them the numbers and websites and law enforcement contact info that they can reach out to. But it's very important that folks know that it's their duty to report. And then it can be reported onto the organization, but we've got to get the investigators involved and the appropriate legal folks involved to begin investigating this case and ensuring the safety of the child.
Yeah. I'm curious too, if you could help people, who, obviously might be out of the state or cause those sort of like you mentioned the mandated reporter, that sort of that varies state by state, correct? And, if so, could you kind of help people understand where they could go at least to find that information so they know, so they're educated?
Yeah. So, one thing I would point out too, Scott, is that, no state in our union discourages you from making a report of child abuse or neglect. So, every state supports the idea that if you have any concerns about the safety of a child, you should report it to the proper authorities. It just so happens in Tennessee and Mississippi, as well as many other states, not all, but many others, they have a legal mandate for their state residents to do so. But it's fairly simple to Google, Department of Children's Services or, things of that nature, whatever your state's, likewise, government entity that serves children and families to make that report. You can just Google child abuse reporting for your state, and it'll probably direct you very quickly to that link. Most states have not only a phone number or hotline, but as well as a website or a form that you can fill out online. Tennessee actually has the ability, as do many other states, the ability to make an anonymous report. So if for any reason you didn't feel comfortable making that report because, for whatever reason, you were concerned about your own safety. It was someone who was close to you, a family member. You were concerned about repercussions. There is the ability to make an anonymous report. And so we always encourage folks to strongly consider that if you're on the fence about, I don't feel comfortable making a report, or I know I should, at least make an anonymous report so that the investigators can check into this matter further. And just because you make a report does not mean that you're making an outright accusation. You don't have to have all the facts. You don't have to have a recording with the child, on your cell phone. You don't have to lead the investigation or ask lots of pointed or detailed questions. You're just simply asking for a professional service to be done. You're just asking the investigators and the folks who are qualified to look into these matters to check in on this child and make sure that they are safe. Sometimes we discover that is in fact true, that they are safe and that nothing has occurred or there's something else going on. A child was demonstrating some behaviors that were concerning to you that are not related to child abuse, but might be related to some other matter. It could be, parents that are going through a divorce or a breakup between a mom and a boyfriend or a father and a girlfriend. It could be drug abuse in the home. It could be any number of things that a child has witnessed that, has led them to demonstrate some behaviors that are concerning to you. But again, we just want the investigators and the proper folks who are trained to look into these matters to look into them further. So you can either call your state's child abuse hotline, which again, you can just Google that, or you can reach out to your local law enforcement entity as well. Both of those groups are qualified and able to help in those matters.
Nice. Chris, I think you made a really important distinction right there. And what you described earlier is very, very similar to unfortunately, a number of situations that happened in my early childhood where situations were known, but they were handled within the church leadership because they were more, they were considered spiritual matters, not legal matters. You know, and now as an adult, I know back, what a mistake that was. So kind of two things. I feel like we've learned, you know, and improved some of these processes. We still have a long way to go. A very, very long way to go. But you mentioned something about these, you know, just reporting isn't necessarily making an accusation. It's simply raising your hand and saying, I feel uncomfortable about this. The whole like, see something, say something. Or I'm reminded of like the Good Samaritan Act. Where like, this is a silly example, but you know, if you're walking through a shopping mall and somebody's in cardiac arrest and you see an AED on the wall, as a Good Samaritan, you are protected by the government to attempt to help someone doing potential harm. You are protected of doing nothing at all. So I think what you're saying is you can just raise your hand and say, I don't love what I feel about this situation. Can someone who is better informed take a look? And that's different than making an accusation.
Yeah. And likewise, Casey, as you just mentioned, Tennessee actually has what's called the Good Faith Reporting Law. So not only are we first responders, but we are also protected as reporters. Again, if the investigators look into the matter and they discover that nothing is going on, you're protected in that. So no one can take legal action against you, civil action. Your employer should not be, you know, letting you go as an employee. Again, I think you'd have a pretty strong case for that type of retaliation. So you're protected by the Good Faith Reporting Law. So again, all the state is asking for you is that if you see something, to say something, to let the proper authorities know so that they can ensure the safety of this child. And we need more folks knowing the signs to look for and then also being willing to do that. And again, I think a lot of that just comes with education.
Well, God, I mean, you just led kind of right into where I was hoping we could go. I mean, so much abuse happens outside of the walls of a church. It happens everywhere. It is, you know, inside, outside, but it just happens. So maybe what are some signs that we could be better informed about to recognize when, hey, man, this is a sign of abuse. I would like to ring the bell. I'd like to raise my hand no matter where it happened. What are maybe some of those signs that we could be better looking for?
Yeah. And Casey, you bring up a really good point too, as far as, you know, not only the idea that we don't want abuse to happen within our church walls, which is completely true, but we also have to be aware of the fact that, you know, even if we could say that our church or house of worship is 100% secure, which no one should say that, but even if you could tell me that, we have to recognize that that doesn't mean that we won't have children who are in our churches, in our houses of worship, who maybe have been abused in a setting outside of our church. And so again, as folks who are serving our community, serving our churches, attempting to shepherd others and spiritually feed others, particularly children, you know, we need to know the signs to look for, as you said. And so, you know, what we often tell folks is that, you know, the kind of obvious thing is that you would think that maybe you would see some physical signs that a child has been abused. But the fact is the physical signs are not always present. Many times they're not. And that could be because the physical signs that we maybe could see are covered up by clothing, and given our nature of the relationship with the child and their involvement in our program and kind of what we're doing, you know, we would have no need to know, you know, where that has taken place, and we wouldn't see that on the child. So it could be covered by clothing in an area that we would not be able to visibly see, which makes sense in a lot of ways. But what I would say, I mean, outside of that, is that oftentimes the abuse may have happened days, weeks, or months ago. And so the physical signs are just no longer present. And that is often what we find in investigations, too, is that the physical signs, you know, there's no need to do a medical exam because the abuse happened, you know, 2 weeks ago. And so the physical signs that maybe would have been present are just no longer there. And so really what we remind folks of is, you know, we need to be keyed in to the emotional changes that we may see in children, emotional and behavioral changes. You know, a child who is very outgoing, who is suddenly withdrawn and sullen, and, you know, maybe a child who was very excited about going to a program or being involved in a certain activity who seems really now reluctant to do so. A child who seems very nervous about being in the presence of another adult or an older or larger child. A child who maybe is using sexual language or is demonstrating sexual behavior that is not age appropriate would obviously be a red flag. a child who is, you know, involved in drug or alcohol use of any kind would obviously be a pretty big red flag. You know, a child who, you know, is demonstrating things like, you know, runaway or self-harm of any kind, you know, a child whose conduct in school falls off or grades fall off, you know, all those emotional and behavioral changes that we might see in a child are really things that we should be attuned to and key in on, because they could be telling us something else without the child even verbally saying those things to us. You know, we can't put the whole onus on a child to just pipe up and share this information with an adult. We know from countless survivors that they never shared their abuse with anyone. They carried that and shouldered that well into adulthood. And many folks who are survivors of abuse who never share with anyone in their entire lifetime about that abuse. And so, you know, we want to know how to spot those signs and to have those important check-in conversations with a child. If we see things that are concerning to us, again, it could be child abuse. It could be something else, but as a caring, trusting adult who's attempting to minister to this child, I would hope that all of us would want to check in with that child to find out more about what's going on.
Well, do you think, Chris, that especially the age of the victim, and I'm intentional with that word, that they don't recognize that that is abusive behavior because the adult that's performing that has taught them this is absolutely normal, trusting behavior. Like, why would a child that doesn't recognize this was wrong say, hey, something wrong happened to me? They don't even have the vocabulary for that. Right. But to your point, it is the responsibility of an adult to go, I see behavior changes. A child who doesn't know better is not going to say something they don't even comprehend yet.
Yeah. You know, Casey, you bring up a really good point about perpetrators. You know, we often remind folks that, you know, 90% of the time, the perpetrator is someone that the child knows. 60% of the time, it's someone that they and their family would say that they know very well. It's someone within the family's kind of inner circle. 30% of the time, it is a family member who's abusing this child. And 40% of the time, it's an older or larger youth that this child knows. So, you know, as we talk about in our Stewards of Children training, you know, what does that really tell us as adults that we should be on the lookout for? It's not the, you know, I grew up, not to date myself, but I grew up as a child of the 80s, and the safety conversations that I had at school and in church and with my family was, you know, about the creepy guy in the trench coat or the guy in the white panel van who was cruising around the playground or things of that nature. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that we discount or don't have those safety conversations with children. Those are still very important safety conversations to have, although, you know, we need to think much more about a child's online vulnerability and how children interact today versus how they interacted 20, 30 years ago. We can't get lost in kind of the old sense of what children may be exposed to versus the reality of what children are facing today. But again, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that stranger danger is not really an important conversation to have, because it absolutely is. But those examples deal with stranger danger and abduction, and that's very different than what child sexual abuse looks like.
Yeah.
Child sexual abuse typically looks like someone the child knows, could be someone that the child knows very well. 30% of the time, it's someone in our own family who's abusing this child. And 40% of the time, it's another youth that the child knows who's abusing them. So, you know, as adults, that really gives us a pretty clear picture about what we need to be on the lookout for. And it's not the convenience of it's always going to be a stranger who's abusing my child. It's going to be likely someone that we know. And so as we're talking about, you know, safety and our bodies and personal boundaries with our children and educating our children about how to keep themselves safe, you know, we need to use real world examples of people that they are around them and interact with them on a regular basis, and let them know if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, whether that be a teacher or a Sunday school teacher or a coach or a friend or an aunt or an uncle or, you know, not as easy to say, but mommy or daddy, if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, I want you to come tell me. Okay. Yep. If anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable online or on social media or via chat or on a gaming platform, you know, I think about, you know, when I grew up as a child, you know, when I sat in my living room or in my bedroom and played Nintendo, I was just, you know, one or two players. It was just me and a friend or whatever. Right. You know, I didn't have the ability to go out and play games with people all around the world. You know, I didn't have social media where I was interacting with folks all across my community and across the nation and across the globe. What our children have access to today is so much broader than mm-hmm. what many of us grew up having access to. And so while technology is a wonderful thing, it opens the door to so many vulnerabilities yeah. and so many things as parents that we have to, and caregivers that we have to stay on top of and be abreast of and know about.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Well, Chris, this conversation is so helpful. And I think what I'm, you know, really hoping too, is that it's helping church leaders hearing it to let this trickle down into the places of their leadership so they can help create safer environments, help, you know, those who have been victims of abuse. And, you know, obviously we're talking to church leaders today. And one of the things we ask everybody who's on the podcast, knowing that we want these conversations to empower healthy churches, we love to hear your thoughts on what is one component of a healthy church.
I think one component of a healthy church is a church who places an emphasis on child safety. And is very willing to have that conversation and recognize the importance of that, and just making that first and foremost. Again, I can't think of a more precious asset or parishioner that we have in our houses of worship and our churches than the children in our care. And so I really applaud those churches who are willing to have maybe some difficult conversations, but place an emphasis on child safety and make that an ongoing part of the culture of that church. And, you know, does ongoing training and has that conversation and, you know, reviews child protection policies and updates that on a regular basis and makes sure that all ministries of our church and all, you know, child and youth serving programs are as safe and secure as we can possibly make them. And making sure that we are of the mind that, just because someone's here to help out and volunteer does not necessarily mean that we can completely trust, blindly trust, that everyone who is helping our church in whatever shape or form that may be has good intentions.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, we so appreciate you sharing, educating, teaching us, and helping so many of the church leaders listening. We do have our last little section of our show we call the Final Five. These are just rapid fire, fast questions coming your way. But we always love to hear the thoughts of our guests on these. So first one is what's one book that you'd recommend to church leaders?
In regards to child safety, it's difficult, right? Because it's hard to vouch for one book being absolutely, you know, everything I would endorse or believe in cover to cover. Sure. You know, a couple that come to mind is a book called On Guard, Preventing and Responding to Child Sexual Abuse in Churches. And that's available on Amazon. Another one is called Safe Sanctuaries. And again, there's an entire child sexual abuse training called Safe Sanctuaries. But this is a book called Safe Sanctuaries that I also I think is on the whole good information. I'd like to tell folks more importantly than that, though, even outside of book resources, which is great. But this whole idea that child safety should really be a conversation among church leaders, our insurance providers, and those who are charged with ministering to children in our churches. I think that is the most important takeaway that I could provide is that, you know, the folks who are ultimately responsible and our insurance provider, and that may seem a little foreign, but, you know, insurance providers are often concerned about, you know, facility safety and things of that nature and making sure that we have policies and procedures in place. So they can sometimes be helpful in kind of pointing us in the right direction about things we should have. But and then again, don't hesitate to reach out to the Child Advocacy Center for training resources, for child protection policy consultation. Those are all things that we can help with and provide.
Perfect.
Awesome.
All right, Chris, what is the last thing that you listened to, like on Spotify or Apple or whatever?
Well, I listen to a pretty eclectic mix of music that I grew up with. So that is always a favorite. You know, something else that I listen to sometimes when I exercise is just, NPR News Now. I just like to stay abreast of what's going on in the world. That can be both, enlightening and disheartening all at the same time. But, you know, that is kind of when I catch my news when I exercise or jog or things like that is, often listen to NPR just to hear more about kind of what's going on in the world around me and to kind of stay abreast of that. So, that's one I enjoy listening to.
What's your favorite piece of technology?
You know, I don't know if I have a favorite piece. I would say most used is my laptop. I tend to carry my laptop everywhere and am often plugged in after hours. So I would say that I don't know if it's my favorite piece, but it's my most critical piece.
Most used. For sure.
Okay.
Most used. And so kind of by default, it has to be up on the list, right? So
Nice.
All right. Is there a quote, a piece of wisdom that has just stuck with you throughout the years?
Yeah, I like the quote that a leader's job is to shepherd, not necessarily to shine. You know, I am someone who is a big believer in humble servant leadership. I think it's our job to raise the morale and to, you know, honor those folks who work around us, you know, to build them up as much as possible, to let them shine. I always admire people who you know, praise the successes and the achievements of others above themselves. Yeah. And that's how I try to operate. And so that is one of my favorite books.
All right, last one. What's one thing you'd like to communicate to our audience of church leaders?
Just don't be afraid to have tough conversations. And child sexual abuse and sex and sexuality can sometimes seem like a tough conversation. You know, children are talking about sex and sexuality at a much younger age than many of our families may have experienced, you know, years ago. Again, the amount of information and content and what children are exposed to today versus even a decade ago is vastly different. And that means that we have to be out in front of this as parents, as caregivers, as church leaders. And so these are not conversations that should be avoided. They should be embraced, and we should be willing to have those conversations and place the value and the importance on the safety of the children in our care.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Well, we so appreciate your time again today, helping and educating and encouraging. And we would love to just hear what, if people want to take kind of a next step and obviously, you know, you're at the Memphis Child Advocacy Center, but where can people go? What can they search maybe to learn more, to grow, to, you know, kind of take the next step if they want to explore more?
Yeah, I would encourage folks to reach out to us at the Child Advocacy Center. We have staff who are highly and specifically trained to educate groups of adults, organizations, churches about child safety, about child protection. So please reach out to us. We would love to be a resource for you. Again, we can provide training. We can provide policy consultation. You know, if churches are looking for opportunities to give back to support children in our community, we have those opportunities as well at the Child Advocacy Center. So you know, I think about things like our bear wall, which is a really special, you know, part of the Child Advocacy Center. A child gets to pick out their own bear after they finish their forensic interview at the Child Advocacy Center. And folks can donate one bear or 10 bears or 100 bears. But we are always in need of bears for children. We know that bears do not solve all the problems of the world. But we do know that for our children who come to the Child Advocacy Center, that bears are a symbol of comfort and hope. And we meet many adults out in the community today who have their bears who visit the Child Advocacy Center as a child or as a teen. So that's a really important part of our work. We also have families who have a lot of other immediate needs, whether that be clothing or school supplies or snacks or things of that nature, you know, things at Christmas time or other times of the year. And so there's a lot of ways that you can reach out to the Child Advocacy Center and you can be involved and help children and families in our community. Who experienced this trauma and who could really use our love and support. And really that's, as a body of believers, that's what we should be all about, right? Is embracing those in our community who need our help and need our assistance and willing to step up and help in that way.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. We'll make sure to link, you know, to a lot of the places that you shared and even the resources, some of the books, all of that for people. But we so appreciate your time today, spending a few moments just talking again about a hard subject, but one that is so important to be talked about. So thank you. And thank you to those of you who have been with us listening, watching. We hope that it's been helpful. Again, our goal is conversations to empower healthy churches. So We so hope that this has done that. And if it has, we would invite you to share it, whether it's sending a link somewhere, subscribing, leaving a review, all of that stuff is so helpful. So we would encourage you to do that. We look forward to bringing more conversations and doing all that we can to empower healthy churches. Thanks.
This episode of the Church Leadership Lab podcast is brought to you by Ministry Brands, the largest provider of church technology software. Over 90,000 churches rely on Ministry Brands for their single platform solution that brings together all the digital tools a church needs, from online giving to websites to church management software and more. Ministry Brands is leading the way in simple to use, innovative solutions, all with the goal of empowering healthy churches. To learn more, visit ministrybrands.com.